Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick, and we're here to talk about the defense from that loss, a really unbelievable loss to the Texans on Sunday. Joining me to do that is Kevin Ostreicher of Locked On Ravens. Kevin, how you doing?
I personally am doing well. The Ravens, on the other hand, not so well. You know, 44-10 to any team is a bad loss. Mentioned that it's to the Texans, and the fact that it was 44-10, but didn't even feel that close, I think, is kind of how I describe that one.
Yeah, it felt every bit as bad as that score indicated. It was a game where the offense was putrid and the defense was just could not stop anybody. So it had all the looks. A defensive embarrassment. You know, it's interesting because in 2012, the Ravens lost a big game to the Texans, who were one of the up-and-coming teams in the AFC at that point. They just lost a playoff game to the Ravens the previous year. And they lost to him 43-13, I think, at midseason. So it was a very similar game. It was in Houston, but a very similar game in terms of being awful and one-sided.
Yeah, and look, I know that the Texans had a lot of motivation in this game, considering how the last handful of matchups have gone, and you know, especially how it's gone in Baltimore for them. So, I mean, that was added motive. You could certainly tell that they were motivated, and you know, it just felt like for Baltimore, and this is a whole team thing, but especially defensively, especially with all the injuries, it just felt like once it started to slip, everything started to slip. And that includes just not only the play on the field, but, you know, it seemed like every TV cut, if you're watching the broadcast, was to an injured Raven or a dejected Raven. And that's kind of the vibes that it's been so far throughout the year.
Right. That has to correct itself with play on the field. The network will not let up with their sideline reporting or with what they're doing in terms of getting pictures of dejected players or pissed off coaches until there's reason to not have pissed off coaches. Yeah. So it's got to figure its way out. Very injured defense, as you mentioned. They sagged again in the loss. They had a lack of ability to generate real pass rush. We'll talk about that a little bit later. This is one of the really bad stats. I didn't try and see how long it's been since this happened, but the Ravens had zero passes defense in this game. They did not get their hands on the football. And that's incredible. I mean, that's really hard to do in an NFL game to go through. I'm sure it's happened in the Ravens' long history. I'm sure they had a zero PD game, but I don't know when the last one was. And I couldn't figure out a way to check it easily, by the way. It's not something you can do in StatHead that I know how to. Maybe if somebody else does, by the way, send me a DM. I'd love to hear how you would get that information, but I wasn't able to figure out how to do it on StatHead, for example. Very soft coverage in the secondary. I thought in particular TJ Tampa was way off on a lot of routes, and he was very soft as it turned up. The Texans and Stroud and Collins and others went for a lot of slants to combat it.
Yeah, and we know that the Ravens defense is largely predicated on the whole bend don't break thing, and that's what people talk about for a lot, where you're not going to get beat deep if you know you're a Ravens defense, like to play a guy back there, patrol that back end of the field, so you're not going to see those like 50-60 yard touchdowns over top of the defense. But sometimes it's the short and intermediate stuff where the Ravens defense says, hey, you know, we're gonna let you take that. And then once you get into like our 25 area, 30, even in the back end of the red zone, they're going to tighten up and force you to kick. The problem is that the defense isn't stopping anything right now. Not only do they not have the personnel to right now, but the play by everybody else out there is just not good. So, I mean, in the past two games, the Ravens defense has had 20 possessions total, and they have only forced two punts total in those areas. When those punts come very late, one punt in the KC game and again one punt in the Houston game. And you know, I think it's interesting because with the turnovers, this team is just, you know, you hear them talk about it all off season. Marlon Humphrey talks about it, John Harbaugh, Zach Orr. The last time the Ravens forced a turnover on a team that was not the Browns was the Texans on Christmas Day back in 2024. So, I mean, it's been a while. That includes the postseason as well. So, you know, you're not giving yourself a chance if you don't turn the ball over. And the Ravens, I think, Ken, in my opinion, are a very momentum-based team. If the Ravens jump on you early, they're off and running for the most part. Like they usually win those games and win them pretty handedly. But, you know, sometimes a momentum play can happen that doesn't go in their favor, or they can't get going, and all of a sudden it becomes sometimes a slop fest. And are the times. I mean, it's very rare to see a Ravens team get blown out like this, although I guess we've seen it the past 2 weeks. So, I mean, defensively, stuff has to change. It's pretty tough right now.
It's things have to change. And basically, in my opinion, people have to get healthy. They can't do it with the current players on the field. A Rams team is going to come in that has a quarterback who knows how to take apart a bad defense and is a fairly talented set of receiving weapons, of skill position weapons, a good enough offensive line. They're not going to have any problem, I don't think, with the Ravens defense. And, if the Ravens were to somehow cobble together a win over the Rams, I think it would be a remarkable achievement for everyone in the building, but probably most for the defense if they're able to do it. They've out-snapped again very badly in this game, 66-40. Now, I've been talking about this week after week, so people probably have an idea of just how bad it's been, but they've been out-snapped by 102 offensive snaps in five games, an average of 20.4 per game, an unbelievable 102 more opposing snaps than there have been for the Ravens. At the heart of that is eight consecutive fourth down conversions for opponents. Now, there has to be some fear for your opponent to go for it on fourth down, but fourth and two, fourth and three, certainly fourth and one is no fear at all. And, they're very opposing teams, and they've played a couple teams in Kansas City and Detroit who really understand exactly when you're supposed to go on fourth down. And I think in terms of the Texans, you may just have a middle of the road team in terms of knowing what's going on, but they weren't afraid to do it when their time came. And extremely frustrating that they've been this impotent on fourth down. That's really been not the whole thing by any stretch, but if you had to find out maybe what the biggest individual significant element was, it might be that fourth down conversion rate in there that's contributed to a lot of it.
Yeah, and I mean, talk about momentum plays. I mean, those are ultimate momentum plays. And we saw that multiple times against Kansas City, even when the Ravens were still in that game. Kansas City went for a couple of those fourth downs and they converted on them. I think the Lions game probably is the one that you can most relate to because that's the game the Ravens were in for the longest, mm-hmm. where we saw multiple times, whether it was Jahmyr Gibbs to the outside and, he walks in or another play like that. The Ravens have had opportunities. They just have not taken advantage of them. And I think for the Houston game in particular, coming into this game, the Texans were the second worst third down offense and the second worst red zone offense in the league in terms of percentage and conversion rates. And the Ravens allowed them to go 4-5 in the red zone and 7-12 on third down. So this isn't like the Bills offense you were playing or the Lions offense you were playing. It just feels like, especially the past 2 weeks, I mean, if you're a struggling offense, you can't get things going. I mean, come on down to Baltimore and that Ravens defense will get you right, which is such a far way away from what we've known this organization to be over the course of their franchise history, which is obviously defense, defense, defense.
Right. I mean, it's a death of 1,000 paper cuts against against Stroud. And this defense is for sure the worst I've seen it since 96. It might be worse than the 96 team. The 96 team had a really good offense, by the way. They had Vinny Testaverde at quarterback who had one of his best seasons. He was a Pro Bowler that year. They could run a really effective no-huddle offense, but they couldn't afford to do it because the defense couldn't stand up to the pressure of having a quick-strike offense that would keep them on the field for more time. They couldn't do it. That also is one of the few teams in NFL history, and the 81 Colts, unfortunately, or another, that were forced to shift from a 4-3 to a 3-4 in season because of injuries. And that obviously it almost never happens. You get new personnel to fill your spots and whatnot, but the injuries on the 1996 defensive line for the Ravens were ridiculous. So not terribly dissimilar. Like that defense didn't have a lot of star talent. They'd have Eric Turner and they had Ray Lewis, of course, as a rookie and whatnot. They had Rob Burnett, who had been an effective player over several years already in Cleveland at that point. But it wasn't a star-laden defense like this is. This defense swaggered into this season thinking they were the best defense in the NFL, and everybody got hurt all at once. And very quickly, we found out that's not the case.
Yeah, I mean, and again, you, from an on-paper perspective, if you're the Ravens this season, I mean, there were a couple spots you could have looked at, who was playing opposite Roquan, or did they have enough experience at pass rush? There were some things that we were talking about in terms of what could be the downfall of the unit, if there was one. And with the injuries, I mean, 100%. Like, you don't have, and we've seen what this defense looks like without Kyle Hamilton. We even saw the stats when Namdi went out. But the problem, I think, has been that even when everybody was healthy, the defense wasn't really playing all that great. And again, the Cleveland offense, in my opinion, like, it was a good, better game from them, but it, you know, it's not the level of the Bills or the Lions or the Chiefs. And again, like, you play who's in front of you, and that early stretch was really tough. But now you're putting yourself in a situation where, like, yeah, without having essentially like your top four defenders almost out there alongside a lot of others as well, your D-line depth has been banged up, and in the secondary, you've been wondering what's going on with Jair Alexander, and now he's back, and Nate Wiggins has been in and out of games a couple of times. It's like you have all those injuries, but, you know, we saw the 49ers walk down the Rams in crunch time and beat them. So it's like every team deals with them. They add context to it. But, you know, it's like you can have like a ton of depth and like the roster is there and everything. But again, like if injuries happen the way that they have so far, I'm not saying it's like, oh, the excuse of all excuses, but it does certainly add context to what's going on.
Yeah. I've grown extremely tired of this being blamed exclusively on the coaches. I'll just say that is complete fucking bull. It's complete bull. Is there some component that the coaches haven't done the most that they could have with what they had? Probably. Have they made a couple of bad decisions? Probably. Do I really think it's at the heart of what's going on? No. The problem is the talent on the field. The problem with the talent on the field is not nearly as good as those other guys who are really trying to win as well. And, you know, it's frustrating to hear explanations of that from coaches who clearly don't want to step on players and you know, treat them as, the, you know, with kid gloves and walk on eggshells and whatnot about not wanting to tell them they're the problem right now. But right now, I mean, the real problem is the Ravens do not have enough talent on the defensive side of the ball that they can actually field at one time to make a difference. They really cannot stop. And a lot of times you can have one or two players which sink a pretty talented defense. They've got holes all over that, starting with a defensive line that really isn't healthy. I don't really believe Travis Jones is healthy. Nnamdi Adebike obviously out for the year. That those two are the pass rush battery for the Ravens. The Ravens pass rush will only go as far as those two take them. And Nnamdi's gone now, and there is absolutely no one to replace him in there. Aeneas Peebles will try, and he'll be gone for a few, you know, three tech plays on obvious passing situations, but his scope is extremely limited in terms of what he can do. I did like what they did in this game a little bit, that they were trying to play Travis Jones as a three tech on some passing downs, which I really did like. Other than that, I mean, the Ravens are, you know, their outside linebacker core is okay. Their inside linebackers are completely screwed with their current situation. Their situation at corner is a disaster. And now their situation at safety is terrible too, with Hamilton being out.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a double-edged sword where, like, you know, some of the play calls, you're wondering, like, okay, why is this the way that it is? And then the players aren't executing on some of the good play calls, and, you know, all that gets blamed back. And, you know, there are so many different things that go on. But essentially where they are now is you still have a very inexperienced defensive coordinator who has a year under his belt, but, you know, still relative to other guys, still learning and inexperienced. And he's now trying his first go at trying to manage a mangled defense with guys who are just flat out inexperienced and don't know where they're supposed to. I mean, there were multiple times where we saw the defense didn't know where they were lining up, or there was a blown assignment, or, you know, a guy comes off of a receiver too early to rush the quarterback, and, you know, Stroud just bloops it over their head. I think it was Dalton Schultz who was the specific play I'm thinking about, or, you know, a guy sees a guy run across his face and doesn't react. Like, there's so many different nuances in the game. And it's true. Like, Zach Orr is not going out there and tackling guys or, you know, blowing assignments himself. But, you know, it is what we're seeing in real time is all of your stars and all of your leaders essentially on defense are out. You're using the green dot on different players and trying to have rookies relay calls in their fifth ever game. And all of that is alongside an inexperienced defensive coordinator. And again, I think the argument for me is, like, I think Zach Orr has a ton of potential as a defensive coordinator. You know, I think that if he were to get fired, and whenever that may be, or if it ever happens, you know, I'm sure he could go on and be successful somewhere else. It's just a matter of, do the Ravens have time to wait for Orr to kind of realize that potential, or is, you know, are they going to say, hey, we need to get someone more experienced in? I mean, the thing is that Pagano's already in the building. And so I think that that's the one-to-one trade-off, in my opinion. And so I don't know if like Pagano gets more responsibilities, but I do think that, and I'm never someone to blame everything on one person or one player or one coach. Like, it's definitely not all Zach Gore's fault. There is a lot at play here.
Let's stick a pin in that one for a moment. We'll come back to it, I'm sure, because of you know, what I've got planned for the show here. But or last year had a trial. The first 10 games of the season were terrible, and the situation happened to be one that was correctable with the talent they had on the roster, very fortunately, to have Marcus Williams and Ajay Jackson play so poorly and be so not bought into the system. And he was able to decapitate and take those two out, get rid of Eddie Jackson. Marcus Williams hung around because of some contract things, or he would have been gone too during the season. And they put Hamilton and Ardarius Washington on the back end, and it all worked out fine. This team's a lot thinner at a lot more positions, has a lot more problems and a lot more lack of experience. I don't know to what degree there's not veteran buy-in, because I don't think it really matters at this point. I don't know that would be exposed yet in terms of, you know, non-buy-in of veterans to some sort of system that Orr has put out there that they don't believe is the correct way to do it. There's so much general failure on this team. You better know how to do the fundamentals and do that. That's why I don't know if he's going to make it past the bye week. I think that is yet to be determined. Let's come back to it. But in terms of a lot could be happening, riding on this Rams game for a number of players and coaches in the building. So we'll come back to that. Anyway, if you look on Odds Checker right now, the Ravens are still a 48% chance to win the AFC North by wagering market. Still the odds on favorite of all the teams. I don't endorse that, by the way. I merely report it. And if you think it's not the Ravens, you can synthetically create that bet very easily. Send me a DM if you want to know how to do it. It's very simple to do. You basically bet an amount proportional for each of the other teams. And you can create that bet. If you want to take not the Ravens at that number, I can tell you exactly how to do it. But anyway, the team is paper thin across the board now. And one of the things that really bothers me about it is injury situations rarely get better. So I can't, you know, they could exponentially improve with the return of four or five players you could name. The obvious ones being Stanley and Jackson and Roquan and Hamilton. I might not even put Humphrey in the top five they need to get back. But if you include... I wouldn't include a Woozie. Maybe it is Humphrey. Okay, let's say it's those five. Then you can exponentially improve from that because you're taking some of the worst players off the field and replacing them with some players who've been among the best in the league. But that's just not the way injuries typically work. Typically, your injury situation degrades continuously, unevenly, but continuously over the course of a season and will typically get worse from where the Ravens are now, not better. As bad as now is, it can be worse. And we've seen it happen before in the four previous seasons that have been completely lost to injuries. 2005, 2007, the secondary of dying men. 2015, with all the incredible run of injuries the Ravens had there, including Suggs and Flacco. And then again in 2021 with the 8-3 start and then six straight losses to close the season with just an unbelievable set of injuries starting with Lamar. So it is possible to get worse.
And they have been historically healthy over the past two seasons.
Yeah.
They've lost very little key contributors for this season. I know 2023, they would lose a couple guys for like a couple weeks or maybe a month. But by the time the playoffs rolled around, they pretty much had almost every key contributor that they needed. And same thing. I mean, both those years, past two, they've been healthy. And I think that's kind of what makes the start to this year sting for a lot of people even more is the fact that they have had three pretty great opportunities so far in the Lamar Jackson era to win a Super Bowl, whether it was 2019 when they came out of nowhere or 2023 and 2024. When even in 2023, everyone was kind of wondering, that was Lamar's second MVP year. And everyone was kind of saying, he's not been able to finish the season in the last 2 years. Is he going to be able to? That was like, is Lamar injury prone or not? And he kind of blew that out of the water. But still, what I'm saying is that for the injuries to happen this way, you know, teams deal with this all the time, and obviously the Ravens have dealt with it a lot, as you mentioned, over the course of their franchise history, so it is nothing new. But also, I like to talk about the fact that, well, it's not a fun thing to talk about, but I just want to like remind people that I think a misconception, Ken, is that when an injured player returns from injury, everybody just expects them to be back to their old 100% self. And like, there should be no drop off or no ramp up period. They just are who they were before the injury. That's very rarely the case. You know, they either need ramp up periods and they're truly by the end of the season, even if you're playing, there's really no 100% healthy in the NFL, considering how vicious of a sport this is. So, you know, especially with the injuries they're suffering, like hamstring injuries are tricky. Ricard's calf, you know, we've heard Harbaugh talk about that, how that's been tricky. Everything. These ligament or soft tissue or whatever it may be, those injuries can be a lot more complicated. And that's kind of what we're seeing a lot of these players suffer right now. So hopefully they're able to all get back. But I mean, even we're seeing it with Likely in his foot, like he's needed time to ramp up. You're muted.
Agree with you completely on the point about the not back 100% right away. So Travis Jones, perfect example from last year, a guy who didn't really ever seem to be back to 100%. Let's move on if we can. Some more general thoughts about the defense. Yeah. There's not a lot that is really worth discussing this game, but we're going to do it anyway in terms of the players are out there. But there's very little positive to say about it. The defense is extremely shorthanded in the secondary. He started with only 7 DBs active. And you had some playing time for players in terms of Martin, Lowry, and Tampa all struggled and all were getting their really first significant NFL playing time. Now, Martin has had a little bit already. Tampa has been in only on some dime packages and a few other stretches at the end of games. Lowry had played a little bit in the previous game, but again, not much. Did he just play one snap against the Chiefs? He might only played one snap against the Chiefs, and he played every snap in this game. And Lowry did not look like the player we saw in the preseason. He looked like he struggled as much as anybody in terms of what was going on. But more significantly is the fact they only went with 7 DBs. I cannot remember ever seeing a team go with 7 DBs. Now, I've been watching football since the 70s. My 1974 pay dirt game has the 4-4-3 as the standard NFL defense. So my guess is I've probably seen Colts games from the 70s where they had only 7 DBs active, maybe even only 6 for all I know. But I don't think it's happened very, very frequently since then or since about 2000, you know, and with the change in the game to an extreme passing game and the high prevalence of it and the high prevalence of 11 personnel. I can't remember it happening in recent years. The Ravens have played with 8 a couple of times, and I've been nervous as hell about that. You have 7 guys. You're going to occasionally play a dime with 6 defenders. You also are using these guys for special teams. A lot of risk.
Yeah, you're stretched extremely thin. And the thing is, it's not even like a lot of experienced veterans you have out there. Even a Nate Wiggins, who has played really well for them over the course of his career so far, is still like an inexperienced player. Jair really was the veteran in that room, essentially. And even he is ramping things up, and that was his second ever game as a Raven. So it's not only the fact that, and you're 100% right, like going with 7 DBs, it's just like, okay, that's a big risk. But other than that, you also have to kind of think about the inexperience factor and that you really just don't have like a Kyle Hamilton who's out there kind of putting guys in position and being that chess piece, or even Roquan, who I know has had a slow start to the year, but you know, even he can like, he understands what's going on out there. And for a Marlin who also hasn't had a strong start to the year, just having that veteran experience. And so, you know, when you're going up against like Nico Collins and CJ Stroud, who again, are not like 10-year vets, but still have been there. They've done that. That's a really tough place to be, because even for a TJ Tampa who didn't really play his rookie season, like, you know, this was going to be the year where he kind of got eased into things and, you know, learning behind a lot of great players and maybe getting some occasional snaps here and there. Then all of a sudden your entire cornerback room is toast, and all of a sudden is, hey, all right, TJ, go out there and play a full complement for us. We need you. Like, that's a tough spot for these young guys to be in.
Very, very tough. And you mentioned Jair Alexander, but he's not really ready to go. I mean, he played as the 4th cornerback in this game behind 3 guys who, you know, Tampa and Martin. Wiggins is one of the best cornerbacks in the NFL, but behind Tampa and Martin in terms of 2 guys who aren't really ready to be on the field full time yet. I mean, it's interesting to get them a trial by fire. It's good in a game you're going to lose anyway for them to get some real reps. So I'm positive on that. We saw reasons why they shouldn't have been out there in this game. Martin, anyway, don't want to go into them individually. I want to instead give you a set of names here and ask you if you know what these guys had in common. It's an alphabetical list. Willie Gaston, Corey Ivey, Landry. I'm forgetting Landry's first name now.
DeJuan Landry.
DeJuan Landry, of course. Chris McAllister, Martin and Pittman. I'll just put their last names out there. I'm forgetting what their first names was. Ronnie Prude, Ed Reed, Samari Roll, Jerome Sapp, and Jermaine Winborn.
Oh, man.
So what do those guys have in common? And the guys in common is that's everybody who played defensive snaps for the 2007 Ravens defensive backfield. Okay. That's how bad it can get at the end of a season. If you've got Willie Gaston picked up from the street to play, you've got Ronnie Prude, who people did have some belief that he'd be a good player after 2006. And then he went in the toilet. Martin and Pittman were never anything. The Ravens drafted Pittman. They traded, I believe, for Martin in a late season or late preseason 1-for-1 trade. And Jermaine Winborn, he's best known for one thing as a Raven. That's a holding flag that gave away the game against the Patriots.
Wow.
So, it can be a lot worse than it is right now in terms of injuries. And I hope the Ravens are not headed there, but their defensive backfield certainly looks like it's in awful shape right now.
Yeah. Can I actually play that game with you too, just differently?
Go ahead.
I have, cause this season I'll never forget it. So I'm going to list off names too. I don't think order or anything. All right. Ladarius Webb, Asa Jackson, Jimmy Smith, Will Hill, Matt Elam, Darian Stewart, Brendan Trowick, Jeremy Miles, Rashawn Melvin, Anthony Levine, Tremaine Jacobs, Danny Gore, Dominique Franks, Antoine Kaysen, Shockey Brown, and Terrence Brooks.
Not a terrible set of backs for their entire careers, but 2015, Hill was still around. They did this. I think you're talking about 2013 right now, but it's either 2013 or 2015 you're pulling these guys from.
Right in the middle, 2014.
Okay.
That was a divisional round when they were signed to Melvin off the street to play. Yeah. And
he had a heck of a start for the Ravens and was a pretty darn good player for a period. But then he got kind of exposed against Brady AFC divisional game. Okay, let's head to some other topics here. Texans had 27 first downs in the game, more than a 2-to-1 advantage over the Ravens. I think they had more than a 2-to-1 advantage in every category, running, passing, and by penalty. It might have been 27-12 for the game. They moved the ball effectively on first down and stayed ahead of the sticks. That led to them being able to convert 8 of 12 on either third or fourth down. You mentioned 7 of 12 on third down, but they also were 1 of 1 on fourth down. So effectively, they're 8 of 12, including the rematches. They ran the ball more effectively than the 5.1 yards per carry would tell you. And there are two big differentiations on that. The first is that they were running out the clock for a portion of the fourth quarter. Second is that they had two kneels in there. And once you factor them out, you're up into the high fives in terms of yards per carry. They were very effective running it. I think the way they drained the last 6:07 of the clock, admittedly, the Ravens were perfectly happy to get the hell out of that stadium, but they ran off the last 6:07 of the clock in just 10 plays, which is incredible. That's an incredible pace to do it.
Yeah.
That got them past the 2-minute warning. So, there's very little to point at this in a schematic way or a statistical standpoint that, boy, they really look good doing this one thing. And I have a couple more specifics I want to get into, but thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was so crazy too to me, because even on like those fourth down plays, they would just hand it off to number 40. I think British Brooks, number 44. Yep. It wasn't even just like, oh, fourth and one. Pick up like 1.5 yards, like pick really close. Six. They get like 6, 7, 8, 9, like just chunk plays there. And so, you take out CJ Stroud's one run, the one carry for 30 yards, and that number goes down a bit. But I do think, like you said, the if you watch the game, you watch the tape, the film tells you something a little. I mean, even on like Nick Chubb's run, you just see guys either out of place, missing tackles. Seems like we're back in like the early 2020s with the missed tackles on this team, it feels like, and that's not a good feeling. I don't have the exact number in front of me with how many they missed in this game, but all in all, for what the Texans were, their offense again was very middling coming into this game. I think they were the 20th ranked rushing offense and the 18th ranked passing offense. Maybe that's flipped, but again, like right in the middle or just below the middle of the league in that. And the Ravens, again, made them look like they're one of the best offenses in the NFL. And they actually did. I mean, Woody Marks was like everybody's breakout pick for this week and all the Ravens defense. And after his game against Tennessee, They actually held him pretty in check,
yep,
relative to what I think people expected. But it was just like the end arounds and some of the other like misdirection plays that the Texans were giving him. And those were just go for like, okay, first and 10, like handoff to Nico Collins as he comes across, second and 2. It's like those are just chunk plays all the way through. So the running backs themselves, I don't think were that effective. I think it was everybody else in the big moments that were making those plays.
All right. I want to save what happens after the bye week for the end of this first segment of this, but let's talk packages for a little bit, because there was one really interesting package situation. And most of the people who want to talk scheme and things about Zach Orr that they're not doing right, they really don't have the information to tell you what Zach Orr is not doing correctly. And if you sit down, it doesn't bear up to any kind of scrutiny. But there was one very bad thing in this game that I need an explanation on. Let's put it that way. So Ravens played 18 snaps of base, 4 passes for 44, 14 runs for 37. Not surprising that we play a lot of base defense, by the way. The Texans use a 6th offensive lineman a lot. They use a lot of 12 personnel. And those are the kind of situations where you typically want to respond with a base defense, 3 down linemen in those cases. They didn't have any big nickel. And I've left this on my list for discussion here, because they've still not moved up Hamilton to play any big nickel this year so far. So I really want to see it. I really want to see the Ravens be able to go back to it. I think it's one of the things that could incrementally improve the defense, but they haven't been able to make that work. And obviously it wasn't playing in this game here. The rush nickel, where they have 1 defensive lineman and 3 outside linebackers. So that's kick a guy inside. You hear that term used. They used that 7 times. It Peebles on the defensive line on those snaps, 7.7 yards per play, 1 sack on those. The standard nickel they used 36 times, and that's what they've been leaning on pretty much the whole time. By the way, all of this is dependent upon what the offense shows you. So you have to go and pick your defense, the best matchup for your defense against the personnel that they put on the field for at any particular time. And oftentimes, if they put out 11 personnel, the best choice is going to be a standard nickel. They go up 6.3 yards per play on standard nickel. I'm going to get to the punchline here in just a moment. Jumbo nickel they used for 2 snaps. Now that there was a particular use for this game that they used 1 of the 2 jumbo nickel snaps, but jumbo nickel is kind of like a change of pace. You put in a 3rd defensive lineman and you take out an inside linebacker while still keeping 5 defensive backs. So that's what jumbo nickel is as I define it. They used to use that a lot under Martindale, 4 to 6 times per game, a lot I'm calling. But they haven't done it too much this year. Part of the problem is that they don't really have great personnel to put a lot of defensive linemen on the field this year, period. But they do have the one thing they have a lot of is nose tackles right now in this team. The team has 3 active nose tackles every week now, it seems. So they could try this kind of jumbo nickel look, which basically means your safeties need to be able to run fit pretty effectively, and your defensive linemen need to hold the line of scrimmage fairly effectively. Okay, and then they play the 4-corner dime, 1 snap. Here's the oddity in the packages, and this is the one we really need to talk about for a minute. They used, I want to say on 14 different snaps, they used a 6th offensive lineman. So he's number 57, Blake Fisher out of Notre Dame. They used him as a tight end. He was an eligible receiver on these plays. He didn't go out on any patterns. He's just there used as a blocker on those plays. I could be wrong. He might have gone out once, but he's not used in that capacity. He's used as a pure blocker. On 6 of those occasions, 6 of those occasions, the Ravens put in a standard nickel against that. That is something I do not recall seeing. So the other team puts in 6 offensive linemen. You almost always move to either base or jumbo to counter it. If it's 4th and 1, you probably are putting in a jumbo unit. If it's goal line, you're probably putting in a jumbo unit. If it's any other place on the field, you're at least putting in a base unit to try and get as big as you can to defend against that 6th offensive lineman. So Orr did this 6 times, and they were fairly effective on those plays. It's about 7.5 yards per play. It wasn't dramatically more effective than their other plays, by the way, but it was effective. And this was a case where I just need a good explanation of why that.
Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's changing the game, Mood.com. They created an entirely line of functional gummies, 100% federally legal THC blends, discreetly delivered right to your doorstep. And here's the best part. You can get 20% off your first order at mood.com with the promo code RAVENS. Now, I've tried a bunch of their gummies myself. Each one's totally unique. The sleepy time gummies knock me out right away. They help me unwind fast, leave me refreshed the next morning. The epic euphoria gummies, they're perfect for when your day just isn't going the way you want it to go. What makes Mood special is how they pair the THC with natural herbs and adaptogens. You won't find blends like this at any local shop. They've got gummies designed for focus, relaxation, clarity, even energy, all made from cannabis grown on small, family-owned American farms. No pesticides, no shortcuts, just high-quality weed you can trust. Plus, Mood backs everything with a 100-day satisfaction guarantee. So head on over to Mood.com, check out their amazing selection, and don't forget to use the promo code RAVENS at checkout to save 20% off your first order.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The Freestyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, or prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
That was the choice. Okay, I don't otherwise understand it because I'm used to every Ravens team in previous history getting heavy against such sets.
I wish I had an explanation. I don't know, and hopefully that's something that'll be asked, but it puts you at such a clear disadvantage that, you know, it in my opinion, does nothing for you. So, I mean, in my opinion, when you look at this Ravens defense, they need all the help they can get, and you can't put yourself in those situations. I mean, I don't understand.
Okay. I mean, you're going with a really light line, two outside linebackers flanking two defensive linemen. So I know you understand, Kevin. I'm just trying to explain it to the listeners here that you know, you're really going small in those situations. You're at big risk of losing the edge in those situations. Either Fisher or your left tackle, someone is going to be able to outflank your widest of the wide, as Billick would say, to get you a good opportunity for that back to hit level two with some speed. And for first contact to occur there. So the Ravens have the surplus of Jenkins, Okoye, and Jones all active among nose tackles in this game. In fact, it'd be one of the heaviest triples ever to play, surpassed only by the previous week when Jones at 341 pounds was replaced by Tupou, who's 350 pounds. So the Ravens had these last 2 weeks, they've had two of the heaviest defensive lines, you know, a team has ever fielded. But they're for whatever reason, they were unwilling to use it in this particular case. If Orr has an explanation for it, I'd love to hear it. If you're in the Ravens media and you're listening to this, ask that question, please. Just why, when Blake Fisher was on the field as a sixth offensive lineman, did you on six individual snaps play only two defensive linemen, a standard nickel against that? Was there rhyme or reason to it? I'd love to hear the answer.
Yeah. You know, guys just getting washed out at that rate. And when you have all those guys active, you need to use them. So I agree with you.
All right, let's jump on talk pass rush for a little bit. We're trying to end this show, if you can't tell, a little bit sooner than we normally do. We normally go about 2 hours. I realize that the willingness to listen to 2 hours of this on a day like today is significantly reduced from its normal time. And people want to vent and they want to hear maybe something that's going on. They maybe want to hear some positive we can take from it. That's a lot of my listeners I know are exactly that. I'm going to have a hard time providing that for you from a game like that. We will have a few things in the individual notes, I'm sure, but let's talk pass rush for a minute. This did not go well for the Ravens in this game. They gave, and I'll just use Stroud to represent both Stroud and Mills, cause I've combined their statistics in these numbers. They gave up ample time and space 14 times. That's 42% of the time that they had ample time and space. By the way, unbelievably, Cooper Rush in this game had 43% ample time and space. Unbelievable. On those 14 plays, the Texans gained 157 yards, 11.2 yards per play, 38 yards above standard. So basically, they just allowed Stroud to sit in the pocket, move around a little bit, make plays. They weren't right down on him on boot plays a couple of times in particular. That really bothered me. But generally speaking, the Ravens, they rushed some numbers in this game. We'll get to that. They were not effective at getting anywhere in the cone to disrupt Stroud.
No, and that's the problem. And again, you don't have your guys, but you know, also I think you have to, if you're the Ravens, you have to get a lot more creative in terms of dialing up some of these looks, because you know, it feels like we had this conversation for years about this team where they just can't generate pressure with four. And then the problem is when they also try to send blitzes, like guys will come off on corner blitzes, whether Keon Martin, Nate Wiggins, they've tried it with a bunch of guys, and even that pressure doesn't really get home. I mean, there are two sacks, obviously. It was one Calvin Noy. That was just a free – he was just a free runner to the quarterback. Yeah, and then, you know, the other one was Robinson missing on Stroud, cutting to the outside with Simpson. Yeah, so I think that even with that context, I mean, it just hasn't been good. The Ravens have been in the bottom of the league in pressure rate all year. The blitz rate has not been there as well. I just think when you're as depleted as you are, you have to get creative. And, you know, any quarterback who is an NFL quarterback will go there. And if you can't get to that cone, like you said, anybody's going to pick you apart. It doesn't matter who's out there.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Apparently, that's not true of Cooper Rush, but normally,
yeah, right. Anybody else, agree. Not named Cooper Rush.
With ball out quick, the Ravens allowed 10 of those plays, about 30% of the total, 55 yards, 5.5 yards per play. Not much difference from what my expectation would be, about 5 yards below it. With pressure, they had 9 plays with pressure. Not a good number, 27%, 38 net yards. That's also not a good number because it's about 6 yards above expectation. But the real problem was the number of ample time and space opportunities and how good the Texans were in those situations. Overall, they were about 39 yards better than their opportunity set would have projected them for, which is more than 1 yard per play. And that might not seem like a lot. That's a lot more than a yard better per play than the opportunity set would dictate. Go on a little bit. Or used 14 rushes of 5+. Now, Orr was not an idiot. He looked at it and he said, we've got to do some other things to generate pressure. And they used their highest rate of 5+ man rushes the whole season, 42%. Detroit, they had 36%. The other games have been lower than that. So the pass rush by numbers results, though, were not particularly good. The Texans got the ball out. With 5+, they had 14 plays for 118 yards. So they gained 8.4 yards per play. I wouldn't say Stroud was like adept at beating the blitz as much as the secondary really couldn't do its part in holding up to that. You know, some of that was TJ Tampa playing kind of soft, you know, other inexperienced players getting a little bit beat. But they weren't up to the task of holding up for an extra half second to allow a 5-man rush that time to get home.
Yeah, I think that with this team, and honestly, the whole NFL, like the pass rush and the secondary, they're so married to one another in so many different ways. And so when you as a secondary can't cover, I mean, that ball's getting out quick, even if it is on a slant, and kind of to counteract some of the blitzing that happens. And, you know, you're right. Zach Gore understood. You got to do stuff to get creative when you're not, one, having the right personnel out there, or just missing, just flat out missing guys like a Hamilton and Matabike and everybody, or two, when guys aren't performing up to their standard. And the problem is that if that pressure does not get home, which, you know, obviously, you know, they've had some issues with that this season, the ball is just going to get out quickly to the short stuff. And again, like, we haven't seen a bunch of those like deep shots over the top because that's not what the Ravens do. But when they're playing, there's such a soft cushion there. It will just be, hey, we're just going to run a quick slant or a quick out and pick up 6, 7, 8 yards every play. And so when that is the game plan, the pass rush doesn't even have time to get home because corners aren't in their spots or they're playing so off or the coverages aren't there. So, you know, the pass rush itself, I think people look at it and they say, oh, well, it's only on the outside linebackers or only on the defensive linemen. But that whole defense has something to do with it.
Yeah, lots of slants and lots of hooks. And you're absolutely right that you know, those things go together like pitching and defense, that they're very hard to separate in terms of their effect on each other. Contrary to numbers, which didn't really work for Orr, the deceptive elements he used were very successful when he used them, but he used them very sparingly. So let's talk about this a little bit. They used 4 off-ball blitzes. That's extraordinarily low, 0.12 per play, resulting in a pass or sack. All of those were singles. They had 26 net yards on those plays. But maybe more importantly, there were 3 pressures, including a sack minus 9 and 1 ball out quick. That's the result you want on a pass play, is to force the quarterback to get rid of that ball. And 4 for 26 with an S-9 included, that's good variance of result that the defense should seek. That's you know, can help you get off the field on the drive if that S-9 really pays off for you. I don't actually remember if it did or not. I don't think so, because I think it was in the long stretch of times where they scored every drive, but it might have. The stunts, they had three, including one double in this game. So it's only two plays. One of them was an ATS. The other was a quarterback hit by Tavius Robinson. So 6.0 yards per play. Nothing terrible about that. Hitting the quarterback once out of two plays like that is good. But here's what that should tell you. When a stunt number is that low, and we've seen two and three, I believe, the last 2 weeks, what that means is that Orr is telling his players, you cannot call any on-field stunts. And he's doing it because he wants to maintain rush lane integrity, or he wants something else to be structured about the pass rush. Oftentimes, it can be because they're trying to set up an individual blitz. They'll call off any stunts for that play. If a blitz is called, you don't talk to the guy next to you and set up a stunt. Otherwise, the general rule of play is that on field, you're empowered to call stunts with the guy next to you when you see an opportunity for it, unless the coach tells you, don't do it. And so this is a case where there was some effectiveness from this deception, and the Ravens didn't make it pay off. You know, I did not go back and look at Christmas Day last year and see how much deception Orr used in that game versus Stroud, but Stroud was under siege in that game.
Right. And I know, again, it is just different personnel, different people out there and guys who are trying to learn their way. So, I mean, it's interesting because there is, like, they need to go very deep into this playbook or come up with new ways to have the deception or different stunts and whatnot, because those are the things that I think will keep the offense on their toes, if anything. I mean, again, they're not getting home with general four-man pressures or very generic stuff, so it's going to be a matter of, can they scheme up enough pressure to be able to get to the quarterback and at least just make them uncomfortable in the pocket, instead of having them sit back there for 60 minutes and fire strikes to whoever they want to. So I think that's something I'm going to hopefully be looking out for in that Rams game, to see how they, and again, against a very experienced quarterback, like you talked about in Stafford, who has seen a lot during his career. So that, you know, it's going to be, I think, less that surprises him than whether it be a Stroud or a younger inexperienced quarterback. But at this point, I think you got to get deceptive with the deception in order to really move forward here.
I thought I had the right game up, but I don't have it from last year against the Texans. I'll have to look it up on the website. But if you do, we can take a look at it, folks. I'd appreciate that you'll do that for me. They had two simulated pressures in the game. They're very effective at those. 2-3 yards per play. One of them, both of them included, by the way, Robinson and Peebles dropping to zone there. So this was more like show a complete seven-man front. In terms of the rush, they dropped two guys out of the middle, very much like what Miami did to the Ravens 4 years ago in that horrible game we all kind of remember with the 40 cover zero looks they showed at the line of scrimmage. They did it twice effectively in this game, and they didn't go to that well very often. Anyway, they got pressures, two pressures from Robinson, a quarterback hitting a pressure. They got Van Noy, had a sack minus eight in a pressure. No other player in the whole team had more than one pressure in the game. So it tells you things are not working out. If you're looking for things where Orr is legitimately at fault, I think he probably could have tried more deceptively in this game, and I didn't understand what he was doing against a sixth offensive lineman. Other than that, send me your thoughts on why specifically Zach Orr's scheme is not working, and I'd love to hear it or probe at it a little bit. These are two things that I see. I mean, you know, I watch for this kind of stuff, and I'm trying to figure out what schematically is not working, on a down-by-down basis. Those were two things I think you could legitimately point to. If you've got other things, I want to hear them. DM me. They're always open on Twitter.
Yeah. You know, I think in order to maximize your personnel, and again, hopefully the Ravens will get more guys back this upcoming week. I mean, that's kind of what John Harbaugh alluded to, not getting everybody back, but at least being a little bit healthier. Maybe that is a Hamilton. You know, that would be a huge gain for them. I think he himself just, I think, brings so much more life back into this defense. You have a lot more at your disposal. And even, like you said, kind of bringing him up a little bit, and even if it's not him blitzing, just being able to move him around the defense. I don't know if they will or not, but I think that to me is big, because I think it frees up so many other guys on this defense to go and kind of pin their ears back. But there's so much added responsibility with so many of these guys out. It's just tough, because you're working with so many inexperienced players at this rate.
It's certainly true. And a lot could happen, obviously, after this Rams game. And I think this is the last thing we really need to discuss is where does this team go if the defense does not step up in week six? Now, you know, there's various degrees of this. There's always 50 shades of gray here in terms of how this might work out. But I think there are a lot of things that could happen. I mean, the best possible situation is Orr finds the magic bullet that has this defense playing together, working towards something, and finds a few tricks up his sleeve that he hasn't figured out yet that turn the defense around, even with some restricted personnel. So we can all hope for that. Yeah. We used to have a saying at my old company that hope is not a strategy. Okay. And
yeah.
So you don't just have a block of business that isn't performing and you hope it's going to get better. You have to make proactive changes typically at that point to make sure that you're managing your risk better than that. So anyway, not to get too deep into the weeds on that, this is something that is not a strategy here either. Hope. Let's assume the worst here though. That the Ravens can't get it done against the Rams, close or far in terms of the difference in score. You know, hopefully it's not another embarrassment of the 44-10 nature, but maybe they lose, you know, 30-17 or something against the Rams in this game. What's on the table for week six? Start with what you think is the most likely thing to happen. What do you think, Kevin?
In terms of like outcome or defensively, what?
I think... Okay, not in terms of the game. I'm saying let's assume the game is a two score win by the Rams.
Oh, okay.
What do you think is the likely result in terms of change either on the field, on the front office, moving forward, whatever it might be? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think at that point it's more likely than not they move on from Zach Orr. Again, I'm not going to set anything in stone, but I think the bye week gives you ample time to get a new guy in there and work around changes. In terms of personnel, I just don't know what you do because so many guys are injured. I mean, we know that in 2019, when the Ravens had those two back-to-back games in week three and week four, where they allowed 500 total yards in each of those games, I mean, Eric DaCosta said, we're not having this. He cut Tim Williams, brought in Josh Bynes and LJ Fort, traded for Marcus Peters a couple weeks after that. So, I mean, I don't know if a trade would be in the cards during the bye week, but again, if the Ravens, and if it's like, 16 win by the Rams or something, where again, you give up 30 points and the defense looks the way it has. I think that they would move on from Zach Orr. Will they? I don't know, but I think that someone has to answer for it and you never want to see anybody lose their job. But I think even after a game like this, someone had to answer for it and that clearly didn't happen. So maybe they are just waiting for the bye week like we talked about, but that's my most likely situation.
Okay. If that happened, you think Chuck Pagano would be interim and then they would get a guy after the season?
Yeah, I think so. I think one for one, that makes sense. And I don't know, maybe you bring DMPs back in another role. I don't know what they do there, but I think Pagano makes the most sense.
Now, Harbaugh alluded to them asking DMPs. I think certainly coaching changes are possible. I actually think it's much more likely that it happens at the defensive coordinator role than it does at the head coaching role. I think that's a much more sticky situation. It's one where I think the Ravens have a predilection for a CEO head coach, and some of it is Bisciotti's management style. He just would prefer a guy who's in charge of hiring that silo as well as it can be done. No matter what you think of John Harbaugh, he's hired a bunch of great coaches over the year, and those guys have gone on to big things. In general, I mean, he's lost a lot of coaches to head coaching jobs. He's done some remarkable things in terms of McDonald and sending him back on the internship to Michigan from being a linebackers coach to there, to coming back as a defensive coordinator, to sticking with him through some very tough times, to extreme effectiveness, and then a big head coaching job for him. He's done a very good job with the coaching hires. And there are a lot of people out there who put zero value on that. I don't have a lot of respect for them, frankly, but there are a lot of people who have zero value on that. And when I think back to 2008, when they hired Harbaugh, they did a great job of explaining exactly the process of the hire in an off-season magazine that was sent to the Ravens season ticket holders. Absolutely great job. Explained it from top to bottom. It's a treatise in good management in terms of how you make good personnel decisions and include a lot of different viewpoints in it. And I handed it out to the other senior officers at work to give them this to look at how this had been done, because I thought it had been done very well. But anyway, I think Bisciotti will handle it extremely well. It is his hire, by the way. I know there's a lot of people under the misconception that somehow Eric DaCosta is the hiring and firing authority. He is not. It's very, very strict. The Ravens organization is built in very clear silos, and all the coaching and decisions fall under Harbaugh, who falls under Bisciotti directly. There is no one above him between the two of them who would be responsible for that hiring or firing.
Right. Yeah. And again, it's a big process, and you know, any coaching change is a big one. So, you know, it's something that the Ravens, you know, they've gone through it over the years, but like it's still always a shock when something like that happens, whether it's written on the wall or written in the stars or not. So, you know, we'll have to see how it unfolds, because with this organization, I just never know. I just truly never know, because they can be loyal, sometimes loyal to a fault, which is fine. I mean, loyalty most of the time is a really good quality to have, but we know that some coaches or staff have extended their welcomes, and, you know, we'll just have to see how it all goes, because I think that, you know, the tension right now in the building, you can kind of feel it around the team. You can feel it with the body language and everything. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks, months, however long.
I mean, first of all, winning one out of six NFL games for any team over any stretch is incredibly stressful for all involved, for the players, for the coaches, for management, probably for ownership in most cases, unless you have an organization that's used to those kind of losing streaks and you're not really, you're expecting it to happen, or maybe you're even planning for it to happen so you can get the number one draft pick or something like that. That's not the Ravens. They're not shooting for the number one draft pick. It'd be kind of ridiculously cool if it did happen, but that's definitely not what we're looking to do here, and not what the Ravens are looking to do. No. I think there are other things that might happen, though, if this game unravels as their third consecutive two-score game. Isn't this a team that has not lost a two-score game that Lamar Jackson has started? He didn't start the last one, but has not lost such a game since that 2021 game at Miami. The 22-10 loss was the last one they lost by two scores. It's been 4 years prior to the game against the Chiefs. But I think we could see a reluctance to hurry back some of the injured players. That may come from the team or the coaches. I think you've got Roquan Smith is out. You've got Lamar Jackson is out. You've got others. If they lose this game, I don't know how quickly players are going to be trying to come back. Harbaugh always has a comeback now kind of way about him, that he never, you know, talks about an injury. We're just going to have to wait and see. We're going to have to wait and see. He doesn't really talk that. He tries to, like, talk the player into an early return sometimes by his mannerisms.
Right. And we see that a lot. And I just, you know, when you look at injuries and, you know, the Perriman thing or the Lamar thing, even like him talking about Ricard, it's just kind of like, well, you know, if we would have known, we would have put him on IR. And now, you know, you're entering a situation where, yeah, that roster spot would have been pretty helpful when it comes to maybe even activating another member of the secondary for last week or whatnot. So you can tell that, like, even, and I get it, like, being asked like questions can be tiring, but, you know, it's his job to answer them. And, you know, he has to go out there, and, you know, he's gotten testy at times this year and snappy with reporters who ask him stuff. And, you know, like, he has to answer the questions. I mean, that's his responsibility. And, you know, and everyone's trying to learn about what's going on. And again, like, the injury situations, like Ricard has been really ominous. And you mentioned the Lamar situation and all of that. It feels like the Ravens want every little advantage they can get. Like, it's every little thing, when in reality, how much do those advantages actually give you? I don't know. Some of them are very advantageous. Other ones, maybe not so much, but that's kind of the organizational philosophy right now.
Well, honestly, if Harbaugh had a single way of referring to injury, of responding to injury questions, he wouldn't have this problem. So if he basically took the Belichick approach and basically said, look, our only comment on injuries is going to be no comment. That's our only comment the entire season. If you ask me an injury question, that's the response I have to give you, Jerry Coleman, or whoever else is going to ask that question, despite the fact that they don't know what the rule is, or they know what the rule is, rather. If you just had that as a stated response, that in M&E work, that's, or in consulting and anything like that, that is the only thing. You have to be worried about insider trading and things like that. That's an easy question to answer. The fact that fans think they're entitled to some sort of injury news is ridiculous in terms of looking forward. I don't want Harbaugh to give that information out, not as an analyst, not as a fan. I want the best possible, you know, constraints on information possible. And for an organization that is so tight-lipped about everything, I mean, they are tight-lipped about every little competitive advantage they think they have. Yep. They gotta do a better job with this. And it's one of the communication things where I think John Harbaugh has kind of failed the team. It's not in his snippiness. If he wants to get snippy about an injury question, go ahead. But the easy way to get snippy about injury question is to have a rule on how you answer them and be consistent about it all the time. Don't try and be a guy. Don't have reporters like you or the fans like you for giving them good news, because you can't give them the bad news. You can't be symmetric about the bad news. So just don't tell them anything. It's the easiest thing, is don't tell them a damn thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'd rather have a no comment than, you know, kind of the wraparound, or, you know, we really thought this was going to be it, but it's really this and that. And I mean, you know, no comment, I think, doesn't get the information out there, which is what the Ravens want. They don't want the information out there. And also, it doesn't, you know, give fans or anybody watching or listening any false hope or room for because that's where, they get in trouble, because Harbaugh says something and then it's interpreted a bajillion different ways. Right. And that's how it goes.
I do have the fear that part of why that's occurred is because Harbaugh may be trying to manipulate the player and push the player into an early return. And so some of those things, if he's trying to do that, I don't really respect the philosophy. I think he's just got to basically say nothing. And you know, they've been a winning organization. It's not like players don't want to play. It's not like they haven't wanted to play for John Harbaugh. In the past, they play hard for him, and they're on the field trying for him. It's just a case of he really, really needs to stop talking about what the situation is with injuries. It's just the easiest out for this kind of a circumstance.
Yeah. There's a much easier way to do it that I think makes everybody happy. So
I got two more things I want to talk about really quickly. The first is an additional emphasis on live fire for young players. I think that might come after a week six loss, if it happens. Now, they already had a fair amount of that in terms of what they've done with the team in this past week, but I think there could be more, and I think it won't necessarily be any kind of seismic shift in the total amount of playing time for anybody. It may be more show up in terms of who returns from injury as quickly as they possibly can. You know, maybe they try and get Lucas Scott on the field as a replacement potentially for Patrick Ricard in 2026. Maybe that Martin is a guy who gets a little more playing time at slot corner to see what he's got, because he's been a very high energy player. Just, you know, he isn't always in the right place. He had a couple of bad penalties in this game. But, you know, I think that's one of the things we may see down the stretch. And you can probably come up with about five or six players, Okoye, finding out who Trenton Simpson is. Jay Higgins, would we like to see who he is as a potential Mike? You know, they have some players that they need to figure out who they are. They could try and figure out who they are. TJ Tampa, the rest of this year.
Yeah, I'm actually, and it's not a this game thing, but I'm curious if and when Adisa Isaac comes back. If he's someone that could maybe carve out some level of a role, because again, like at this point, I mean, no one else has stepped up. And I don't know the timeline on Isaac coming back, but you know, whenever that is, I think he could be someone. Even like, can Ajabo make that final push? That's someone that, you know, time is quickly running out in Baltimore, considering the production has not been there, and you know, kind of almost made the roster because Isaac got injured. I mean, I don't think he was making the roster if Isaac was healthy. So this was kind of his last opportunity, and if he's not taking advantage of that, well, I think he's probably gone. But you know, you have other guys on the practice squad, like you mentioned. The Lucas Scott one is really interesting to me.
Yeah,
I just feel like they're missing that Ricard role on offense, and you know, Zaire's come in, and you know, he's done his best, but I think for what the Ravens are on offense, Ricard is a really big part of that. And I think Scott is really intriguing.
Yeah. He's you know, one of a number of players, and they're not all going to have huge roles, but you get to see what you have for 2026. Corey Bullock is a guy you probably want to see some snaps from, because you may be without Tyler Linderbaum next year. And you may want to really see what he can do at some point.
That's a really all good right. one.
Going beyond that, I did have one more thing, and that is the possibility of a fire sale of contracts. Now, I'm going to have an episode coming up on this on the bye week, but they have a number of players on expiring contracts who have significant value on the trade market. Now, really important thing, a bunch of players that can't be traded. Roquan Smith, you can't trade him because you can't absorb the cap hit from trading him. Neither side can. So contending teams are always going to be tight to the cap, and the teams that are trading, in this case, the Ravens, don't have a lot of cap either. So the Ravens need somebody to take on the entire contract. The best player to trade, the player who had the highest value, is an expiring first contract player. So the guys that are out there are some of the guys we've been clamoring for to be signed all offseason. So it's Adafi Owe, which I know a lot of people thought he was priced out anyway. Isaiah Likely, who the Ravens apparently made an offer to. Tyler Linderbaum would be one. If he's going to be gone, you better get something for him. Travis Jones, I'd be incredibly upset to see Travis Jones leaving Baltimore, but that may have to be the way of it if this is where the Ravens are right now. He certainly is one of the assets who's worth maybe the most of their individual players in terms of what they could get for him. Mark Andrews is up there, and then Charlie Kohler and even Daniel Faalele. I mean, I know a lot of people laugh at this, but Daniel Faalele is a league average guard who the Ravens could possibly trade and get something for. And it's a, yeah, he's in his fourth year with the Ravens. I know he's a guy who could be re-signed, but he's also a guy who could be very valuable to another team.
Yeah, I mean, and there are the reports about, you know, Andrews and kind of what that mm-hmm. looks like. But, you know, it, in my opinion, I just, I don't know. I think for me, I don't know. Andrews, in my opinion, could be the one. I just don't think that, like, is Linderbaum, what could he command back in a trade on for like a rental? Like a heck of a lot, but
I it would be a pretty good amount. But the thing I would take, I'll tell you what I'd take, and I'll give you a minute to think about it in terms of what you'd take for Linderbaum. But I'll tell you what I'd take for starters. I wouldn't need a 2026 pick for Linderbaum necessarily. I'd trade him for a 2027 second round selection. So it's like a 2026 third round selection, a lot of people would say. Now think about what the Ravens would get for him in terms of leaving the team. The absolute best they could do if he left the team would be a third round selection in 27. So this is above that, and it has to be above that because Linderbaum is very cheap for the remainder of this year on this contract, and that has value. So in terms of the incremental marginal value you get, I would do it for that. I think, you know, either a third rounder next year or a second rounder in 27. How about you?
Yeah, I'm totally fine with that. I would maybe try to hold out for a second. But I think, again, if you're going to get a third, I agree with the value. Like, if that's what you're just going to get for him anyway, I think second is what you want to do. I'm totally fine with that. I mean, a first is probably steep, but... Mm-hmm.
No way.
I mean, I'd love it, but I don't think that's happening. I think second is probably your sweet spot.
I mean, they traded Orlando Brown before his fourth season and got a mid second round pick for, you know, a player that the Chiefs were projecting in at left tackle at the time. That should act as an upper bound on what a team could hope because the Ravens trading him to an arch rival in so doing was a really questionable move from a lot of standpoints. They had to do it to unwind that 2018 draft because it had been so good, but it was a tough trade for them to swallow in terms of who they were trading him to.
Right. Yeah. So it does depend on circumstance and situation. I mean, and again, in the deadline, you would have, if you make it clear that you're moving on from these guys, whether it be Linderbaum or someone else, you could maybe get a bidding war going on, and you could take a deal like, hey, maybe the price is like late second, but then the team comes in and says, hey, we want them for the long term, but our pick is going to be 15 picks higher or in that wheelhouse than the team that you might trade them to. And the Ravens say, okay, like, hey, we're going to pit them against each other and see how that works.
Yeah, you could do that. And you could certainly trade a first for a second kind of thing. So the Ravens would be giving back what this year might be a fairly high second round pick in exchange for a low first round pick to a contender. That kind of thing could happen. But it's not going to net a pure first round pick. You won't have anything like that happening. The equivalent should be, you know, at a very, very positive level would be like a second round pick. I think in 27 would be what they'd be looking at.
Yeah, I'd be fine with that.
All right. Kevin, great talking football with you. We did go much longer than expected, but you know, we get into some of these discussions and we get going for a while. Tell folks where they can find your work online and contact you if they want to.
Yeah, you can find me over at Locked On Ravens. We're a 5-day a week plus more daily Ravens podcast. You can subscribe over in video form if you like to watch on YouTube, or if you're just an audio listener, you like to listen in audio form. We're available wherever you get your podcast, free and available over there. I do some writing over at the Ravens Wire, and you find me on social media at ChaosTracker34, Twitter, Instagram, the whole nine yards.
All right. Outstanding. Thanks for coming on, Kevin. Other folks out there, thanks for listening. Extended episode here, when we didn't really intend for this to happen, but we appreciate the loyalty of the listeners here and the fact that the listens have been growing even in a season like this. Kevin, thanks again for coming on.
I appreciate you, Ken. Thanks so much.
And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.